morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to the TT Podcast. Well, here we are in that liminal space, wedged between the two best cobbled races in the calendar. Joining me to discuss Flanders past and Roubaix future is my co-host Tom. Tom, how are you?
I was just saying to you, I'm actually not very well. I don't feel good at all. But nothing can stop us tempting fate for a second week in a row and trying to preview these races. Firstly, I do have one question.
Yeah.
What does liminal mean?
I'm really hoping you wouldn't ask that, because when I wrote it, I was unsure. But I think it kind of means that kind of purgatory space that, like, someone can Google it.
Actually, the moment I heard it, I was just like, what? I've never heard that word before in my life.
It's just a fairly poetic word that often goes with the word space that added a few extra syllables into the intro there.
Well, there you go. The listener can infer from context.
Yeah, and thanks for calling me out for that. While we're fessing up to things going badly for us, tipping Wout van Aert, we were making the mistake again, Tom, of recording on a Tuesday. Last week, that didn't go very well for us because Wout van Aert crashed out at Dorsdorf Landeren on the Wednesday and basically made
season.
our whole preview defunct.
Yeah. bad crash as well, really bad one. It looked brutal, like half the skin off his back last week as well. Really not very nice.
Well, this is what you messaged me and you said that there, some people have been saying about how there were videos of him crying because he was going to be missing the Tour of Flanders and Roubaix. And you said...
I said, like, lads, he's got about 7 broken ribs or something. I think that's probably causing him more pain at the moment. That was a bad, bad crash.
Yeah, he's lost all the skin off his back. I think that's probably what's making him cry.
Yeah.
There's talk of him going to the Giro.
Well, he did... He posted on Strava this morning. He's been out for a run back in Belgium. So he's obviously not ready to get on the bike, but he's done, or maybe it was a walk. It was something on foot anyway, but he's been out the house.
Yeah, look, it doesn't, if you're going for like a short run or a short walk, it doesn't exactly tell me that you're going to be doing a grand tour next month.
Did you break a collarbone when you had your crash?
No, 3 bones in my face and a wrist.
So I have broken my collarbone playing football on the playground before, not cycling. And you can't run on it. You just can't support your arm at all. So I don't know how he's out doing that after a week or so.
Well, this is it. Like when you're running, I guess there's the sway of your arms. So that would hurt. When you're riding as well, surely the pressure that you're putting down onto the handlebars is a bit sore.
No, it was my left collarbone. And unless he's running with his arm in a sling, which is unpleasant and uncomfortable and inefficient.
Sounds quite dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, he's a professional athlete, so you never know. But no, for 4 to 6 weeks, I can't remember, I couldn't hold up my arm.
Okay, so this is our professional medical intel, is that we think it's unlikely that Wout van Aert will make the Giro d'Italia.
To be honest, I think cycling's easier than running, because you can rest the arm on the handlebar, can't you? But
okay, the Giro dream's back on.
Yeah, no, yeah, definitely.
Let's talk Flanders, Tom. It was wet, it was muddy, it was glorious, wasn't it?
It was, and it was just that right kind of wet, wasn't it? Especially during the, basically, I'm going to go straight to the men's race on the Koppenberg, where we just saw those scenes where it wasn't just wet, it was slippy, it was oily, there was absolutely no traction at all. Really just grim conditions, not grim, but difficult conditions.
Well, this is, I think that was one of the obviously lasting images of the race, was the riders running up the Koppenberg, like the whole peloton basically. And it was something that
how often do you see the pro peloton getting off the pedals and having to carry their bikes up the hills?
But it was so nice to see. It was like, wow, they're human. And obviously the TV never does it justice, but the Koppenberg is like, I saw somebody tweet yesterday saying that they'd walked up to the top of the Koppenberg in walking boots and they couldn't get down.
Have you got the gradient to hand? Because I haven't, but I know I did have it 2 days ago and it's steep.
It's over 20%, which on like a flat, dry road of asphalt is tough. But it showed this race, and this was basically where the winners came from, was early in the race. And I don't think we've ever seen it in modern memory where they've come from this far out. But the positioning onto that climb in particular was so crucial to how the races then played out.
You're right. I can't remember a race a Tour of Flanders, sorry, where someone hasn't gone on the Oude Kwamen or the Paterberg at the end, basically, to be honest. For the decisive moves and all the action to come 40-plus K from the finish line was unheard of for me.
But and this is why I think it was interesting with Van der Poel. I mean, people talk about Van der Poel as being, you know, just a brute of a rider, like super powerful, just stronger than mm-hmm. everyone else. What he showed in that race for me was that he's tactically ahead of everyone else as well. He knew that he needed to be at the front on the Koppenberg. And it's like he attacked on the climb before that, but it wasn't really a very meaningful attack. He knew he wanted to get into the Koppenberg first so that if anything happened, he would not be held up. And that's what happened. I mean, he's a six-time cyclocross world champion, so it helps that he's used to his wheels slipping and sliding. He feels comfortable when that happens, and he can continue to put the power down. And that, I mean, he went over the top of that hill with like 7 seconds, and then because everyone else was slowing down behind him, got 30 seconds. Suddenly, he's almost at 2 minutes.
It's one of those, isn't it, as well? Like, you have seen that with later attacks in previous Tours of Flanders, where it's only a 10-second gap over the top, but if you're riding away from people there, they're not catching up immediately. You can still grow that gap off the hill because you have better legs than them still. And it seems quite common to see those gaps just... You eke out a small one, and then it just grows and grows and grows. And obviously, when you've got the legs that Mathieu van der Poel has over the rest of the field, sometimes it really grows.
But it's the same thing happened in the women's race. I mean, we didn't see it to the same obvious extent, but like Esti Works, for lack of a better word, bollocks it up at the Koppenberg. They were too far back. Capecchi and Vollering were not at the front. Vollering didn't. Capecchi certainly has put a foot down. She was running up it. Then there was that odd scene where Vollering runs alongside Capecchi. She cycles alongside Capecchi running. And it makes for this kind of like cartoonish circus-like image on the screen. And you just know from that moment with 45 kilometers to go that they are not getting back into this.
No, because if you are at the back, it's such a bottleneck, isn't it? Because once one person at the front slows, everyone slows. And you're either, it's essentially the same as having a crash in the peloton. If you're on the right side of it, then you've all of a sudden got a massive gap. And if you're the wrong side of it, your race is over.
And that's what we saw. A couple of things I want to highlight from the men's race, Tom. Number one is the podium.
Okay.
Can you remember who came second and third? This isn't a quiz. I'll tell you. This is not.
Michael Matthews got third and was then relegated, and I don't know who was put in his place.
So second was Luca Mazzato of Arkea yeah. B&B Hotels.
Mm-hmm.
Third was Nils Pollitt.
But did Pollitt cross the line fourth?
He crossed the line fourth and Matthews got relegated.
Yeah.
But I mean, that is telling for me of how unpredictable and random that race was.
Obviously, we didn't talk him up, but Nils Pollitt is a name when I go through and read other people's previews before we talk about it. Nils, he's a name that's just sort of mentioned on the periphery. He's one, you know, one to watch, but never one that anyone's ever particularly worried about.
So I look back to his results. He came fifth at Flanders before, but otherwise, generally, he hopes to get somewhere around 20th to 40th. 30 years old, he's only ever won one World Tour race. Luca Mazzato, 26 years old, has never won a World Tour race. And suddenly the two of them are on the podium at Flanders. I mean,
what race, won? He won a tour stage.
He won a tour stage in 2021.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the race, this is what was funny about the race, is that it panned out exactly how people expected, that Van der Poel would solo away, obviously not as long range as it happened. But then what happened behind it was just like mayhem.
Yeah, I mean, look, to be honest, I was, once Van der Poel went, I messaged you then and there saying, you know, shall we call it now? And you did say wait for the Quorum, but it wasn't necessary. He was gone, and I'll admit I switched back over to the football. So I didn't see any chaos for the lesser positions in the top 10.
There you go. Well, maybe that says something about the enjoyment of it when a rider is off the front, that you are more inclined to switch over to the football.
When it's a rider like Mathieu van der Poel, and look, we all knew once he'd gone, there's not really much hope of anyone bringing him back in, is there?
And that kind of leads on to my second point, which is another thing I wanted to talk about the men's race, was the speed of it. Now, 44.5 kilometers an hour. It was the fastest ever Tour of Flanders in history. Interestingly, I think when you look at the start of that day and you see the mud and the wet and the rain, it's not exactly peak conditions. And we have had, last year we had the fastest ever Paris-Roubaix. This year we had the fastest ever Milan-San Remo. Race speeds are getting faster and faster. And somebody said to me the other day, they were like, why is that? Like, obviously what they were implying was that there was some sort of, I guess euphemistically, dishonest means.
Yeah, we all know what you're hinting at there.
But is there an explanation for it? For me, it's not that surprising.
You know, I think in races like these one-day classics, there was a lot. I think there was a lot of scope to make up time anyway. Because if you look at the sort of times that riders are doing in the high mountains, when they go up those climbs, they are nowhere near as quick as what people were doing in the 90s. So you can throw all your euphemisms at it you want, but it's certainly not the same situation as it was then. I think in terms, especially over the cobbled classics, I just think in terms of the bike technology and what riders are able to do, and you're looking at also a lot of riders coming over with a cyclocross background and stuff. I just think that with races like Flanders and Roubaix, there has always been a lot of scope to make sort of material changes that aren't about the rider. And obviously there's probably a lot more data science and analytics and nutritional whatever going on behind the scenes as well that these riders have never had as well. So yeah, I mean, it doesn't surprise me too much.
Well, I think the basic thing is that nowadays riders have completely different setups for the classics as they would for a mountain stage. You throw back 20, 30 years ago, they're using the same bikes. They're probably using the same tire, not much difference in the tire pressures. They're using 23 millimeter tires. Now they're riding 32 millimeter tires with extremely low tire pressures. The kit, as you say, the kit's better, not just the bikes, but like the skin suits are better. The helmets are better. I also think it's just the pros are better now. Like it takes, in this age we live in of data driving or data driven analytics, they are genuinely finding the best pros. Like they, at a young age, they're finding the riders that can put out the best watts, the best people, the creme de la creme, and they are the ones that are becoming pros. It takes more and more to become a pro nowadays. You can't just kind of walk into the sport anymore. Not that you could before, but it's harder to. And maybe I'm making excuses. Maybe this will all be very badly aged when it comes out that there are dishonest means. But for me, as I say, it's not surprising.
Well, the other point I was going to make is I simply think the roads, and especially the cobbles, are much better maintained as well. You go back to, you know, the Roubaix of old and probably even these Flemish climbs. They didn't try to maintain the roads. They actively made it as horrible as possible. And they're now, you know, with maybe it comes from a rider safety perspective or maybe it does come from a speed perspective, but they're riding smooth roads when it's, you know, it's motorways and whatever, and they're not riding massive lumpy cobbles as they might have used to have done.
Kind of comparing it to the past as well, just to name drop someone here, Tom, I was speaking to Magnus Backsted recently. He won Paris-Roubaix 20 years ago, and he told me, he was like, the tech is different, that just everything, the whole race day is different, the nutrition's different, the amount of recons we were doing is different. But the point he made to me, which I found really interesting, was when he won Paris-Roubaix 20 years ago, it took him an hour longer than what it took Mathieu van der Poel last year. An hour longer.
I mean, that's obviously on every given day, you can put it down to conditions and stuff as well. But an hour over 20 years is an enormous gap.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we're comparing two different dates. Conditions could vary massively. So it's harder and harder to compare them. But I think it's an interesting conversation to have.
Especially, I mean, Roubaix is the one race as well where I would say each individual edition is just can't be compared to anything else because you never know how that race is going to go. And the unpredictability is what makes it what it is.
Yeah. Well, we'll get onto that in a second. Let's touch some more on the women's race here. Talking about unpredictability, Tom, we both predicted that Lotte Kopecky would win by a landslide. She didn't even finish on the podium.
No, she did not. If you're about to ask me who the podium was, I have Googled it in advance since you asked me the men's one.
I'm not going to ask you who the podium was. You can tell us who won it.
Well, Elisa Longo Borghini won, who I
Which was
did give a
a,
little mention to.
yes, it was a great win. Like really well maneuvered, really well manufactured by Little Trek. Shirin Van Anrooy thought she was going to win it. She then, I don't know if she's under team orders or what happens, but the way they on the road made decisions during that race was brilliant. Like they knew that Van Anrooy wasn't going to make it by herself. So she waited up. She rode then for Elisa Longo Borghini, who, to be fair to her, said afterwards that Cassie Nuvidoma was working with them brilliantly and thanked her for that. And that's why that trio stuck it to the line.
It was 9 seconds the gap on the line between that front trio and the next group, which did include Lotta Kopecky and Marianne Vos, and you don't want to be going to the line with either of those two.
Yeah, I mean they played it. They played a blinder. The way as well, Van Anrooy opened her sprint up first with like 250 meters to go, forced Nuvia-Domer to kind of respond, and then Elisa Longo Borghini was like, "Great, well I'll just take your wheel and pit round you at the last second." It was
Exactly. I
really,
mean,
really
that's
well won.
very well worked, but I mean, also very simple. When you've got two against one, that is obvious, that's the way to do it. If someone's willing to essentially lead it out and probably sacrifice their own chances.
I thought it was nice afterwards that Elisa Longo Borghini thanked her coach. We touched on in our preview that obviously last year she had a terrible year with COVID. She had sepsis. I'm sure she was in and out of hospital a lot last year. And then she was nursed kind of back to health, got back into training, and is now back at great form. And it was nice to, have a nod to the coach.
No, and I think you're right. It goes back to what we were just talking about the advances and stuff. It's not an individual sport anymore. There's so many people working behind the scenes for each rider to get out and do what they do.
The other key talking point I want to talk about from the women's race, Tom, is white bib shorts.
Okay, I know you. This is a subject that's close to your heart, so I'll let you take the lead.
Yeah, look, I love white. I love anything that's not black bib shorts. I love white bib shorts. I used to love the brown bib shorts. My issue is, I think if you're the world champion and you're gonna wear white bib shorts, you've got a win in them. You can't run up the Koppenberg in white bib shorts. It was a sight, and it was like, again, it was brilliant. Like in this sport, we love to see fallen heroes, right? It was why when Tadej Pogacar was on the ropes in that Tour de France against Vingegaard, it was why when Pogacar beat Roglic in that time trial on the Planche des Belles Filles, everyone sympathized with Roglic, Pogacar in those moments, and which is why their kind of fandom grew bigger and bigger. It was the same for me with Capecchi, like just seeing her suffering, like not being able to get back on, being on the back foot in white bib shorts on
Yeah,
the
I mean,
muddiest day of racing this year.
I don't think it necessarily falls under, that sort of curse of the rainbow jersey thing, does it? But you've seen some horrible, horrible things happen to world champions over the years.
The last world champion, last female world champion to wear white bib shorts, Tom, since I'm sure you're very curious.
I've seen you've got a long list here.
It was Lizzie Deignan in 2016. That's that courtesy of Abby Mickey in Escape Collective. 2016, 8 years, Tom, 8 years since we've had white bib shorts. And now I fear that Lotta will not be wearing them again.
Yeah, I don't know. That's not a prediction I'm willing to make.
You've got no strong opinions on white bib shorts.
I'm afraid not. I'll leave that up to you. White, brown, any color. That's the fashion expert in this podcast is you.
Thank you. Okay, great. Let's move on to Paris-Roubaix, Tom. We know what happens with Paris-Roubaix. It is the one of the most dangerous, feared races on the calendar. It's also one of the best to watch. What are you looking forward to this year?
Right, I'm going to start by saying the weather forecast has changed. We've been told rain for at least the last 2 weeks, and now 3 days out from the race, 4 days out from the race, they're going, no, it's dry. So
Well, we had a wet Flanders. We can't have both.
that's very upsetting. And look, a lot of what we say here could be quite similar to our Flanders preview because we're very much looking forward to this showdown between all these big names, of whom probably only Mathieu van der Poel remains.
Yeah. Interesting one with Paris-Roubaix, Tom, is that I've actually been out this year and done a recon off the course.
So what's the inside knowledge that you've got for us?
Well, the inside knowledge that I have, so I went out with Life Plus Wahoo, the British Continental team, and Hunt Wheels, who supplied to Life Plus Wahoo. They rode the last 100 kilometers, which is basically, they rode every cobbled sector in the women's race. And the consensus was that the cobbles are the worst they have ever been. Contrary to what you were saying earlier, like there's just,
doesn't make me look very good.
Yeah, so many janky cobbles, like jagged everywhere. This was 2 weeks ago I went, and the consensus was that, like, I spoke to the mechanic and I spoke to a local on Monzon-Pebel sector, and the consensus was that they will try and fix the worst bits, because you obviously have the Ami de Paris-Roubaix. There are different farming schools as well. They've got the goats aren't fixing the cobbles though. but there's just too much work to be done before race day. So there will be some essentially season-ending cobbles out there. It's whether they are able to avoid them.
Crashes, punctures, the works. Well, because the one thing I have been reading this week as well, I think was in L'Équipe maybe yesterday, they're considering adding a chicane in on the lead up to the Arenberg when they go over that level crossing. I know the women don't go through the Arenberg still, do they? But obviously, no. In the men's race, they don't want the riders coming over that level crossing and onto the cobbles at 60, 70k an hour, because it almost kills someone every year. So they're also considering adding a chicane, a zigzag, some sort of, you know, slow down corner, basically, anyway, to mitigate for the state of that.
But it's interesting you bring this up, Tom, because for the first time ever, this is essentially breaking news on this podcast, although this podcast won't go out until 24 hours time. that has happened. The organizers of the race have, as of half an hour ago, have decided they're putting a chicane in.
Okay.
At the start of the Arenberg.
I read the rumors yesterday.
Very good. Which for me, I mean, look, I'm no race organizer. Even though we've got great ideas for a monument in the UK. for me, what that means is that fight that they have to get into the front of the Arenberg that they're trying to slow down is now just going to happen 100 meters before.
Selfishly, I don't want it. I know it's there from a rider safety perspective and is obviously important, but from a spectator's perspective, you want this free-for-all and you want them wrestling for position and you don't want them crashing, but you know, it adds a bit of tension and a bit of drama, doesn't it?
The Arenberg is brutal. When I went last year, we went to see the recons at the Arenberg. Like, it's narrow and it's so long, but it's also like very downhill at the start, which is why they get up to like 60 kilometers an hour. The reason, for anyone wondering, the reason why the women's peloton don't do the Arenberg is because it comes so early in the race. The men's race starts in Compiègne, which is further south, and the women's race starts in Dinan, which is north of Compiègne. And the Arenberg is basically like 3 kilometers outside Dinan. So they would basically start and do the Arenberg within 10, 15 kilometers off the race beginning. Yeah. Which they have decided just makes no sense.
How far is Compiègne from Paris?
Quite far. Oh, as in like, they shouldn't call it Paris-Roubaix if that's what you're getting at. But Compiègne-Roubaix doesn't have the same ring to it.
All I know, I assume Compiègne was close, because we must have talked about this in previous previews in previous years, but Compiègne is where they signed the armistice for both the World Wars. So the First World War, they ended it in the Forêt de Compiègne, or what's called it. I think it's a forest. I don't know how they translate it into French, but the Germans and the French and whoever signing the armistice agreement there.
It is, right, here you go. It's an hour and a half, 85 kilometers outside Paris.
Okay, that is cool. Yeah, weirdly far then.
Shall we talk some favorites, Tom?
Yeah, let's do it. Should we just get Mathieu van der Poel out the way?
Well, the good thing this week, Tom, is that there are no big races where these favorites are going to be racing before Paris-Roubaix. So they can't crash unless there's some sort of tragic training incident that we could only be responsible for at this point. I'm happy to get Van der Poel out of the way. Let's just establish.
We've said about him. He's the favourite. We all know he is. He's the reigning. He's the defending champion as well. He's won Flanders last week. He's in the rainbow jersey. He's Mathieu van der Poel.
Okay, you told me before this that you have eyes on Mads Pedersen.
I, to be fair, always have eyes on Mads Pedersen, but I think he is the one guy who's gone up against Van der Poel this season and been able to beat him at Gent-Wevelgem, was that, I think? Yeah, so I think of anyone in the peloton who isn't Mathieu van der Poel, he's showing the kind of form to be able to beat him. Especially, you know, if they get to the Velodrome together, I think Pedersen's a faster sprinter.
I agree.
So on that basis alone, assuming he can get over the cobbles, I think he can. Pedersen's shown plenty of times he's got the all-round ability. He turns up in the stage races. He's a former world champion as well. I think he's certainly the main threat.
Okay. I'm not going to tip someone else for the win. I'm going to tip someone for a surprise podium.
Mm-hmm.
Josh Tarling.
Okay, that is a surprise.
Now, Josh Tarling last year became the youngest ever rider at Paris-Roubaix, in the men's Paris-Roubaix. Youngest ever. Oh, no, maybe not youngest ever. Youngest for a certain amount. Maybe it was the youngest ever. I can't remember. He was 19 years old. He's now 20 years old, because that's how time works.
It is a year later, yep.
He hadn't finished a monument until Flanders. So he didn't. He was out of the time limit at Roubaix last year because he was brought down in a crash and then struggled through to the Velodrome.
Mm-hmm.
Flanders finishes 17th. He was the first Brit home at Flanders.
The only thing I would say to counter that is that Ineos are having an awful season, have been nowhere in any races.
You know, I think I saw a stat yesterday that was, I think they've only won one race this season, maybe. And the only team that's done worse than them is Cofidis.
As it's always Cofidis, but yeah.
They won the national Ecuadorian national championships with Jonathan Narváez. We're not counting that. One race. They won a 2.1 time trial at O Gran Camino with Josh Tarling. Only thing they've won this year.
They've got to break the duck at some point, haven't they?
And Josh Tarling is on a winning streak. I have a good feeling about this. I think if he can get himself in the front group, he will be able to last to the line and he could try to go long.
Yeah. I think a podium is very ambitious, but you said it was a rogue one, so we'll allow it.
Okay, we'll stick with podium then for Tarling. Women's race, should we just both? Well, interestingly, again, you said this, I'm not going to take credit for this, but you made the point, and the obvious point somewhat, that SD Works Pro Time have never won Paris-Roubaix.
They've never won Paris-Roubaix.
Distinction of that comes that the race is, this is only the fourth edition of the race. Mm-hmm. But that is still interesting.
And well, the other point I wanted to make was I've said it already, the unpredictability of Paris-Roubaix. And, you know, we saw something like Alison Jackson winning last year riding for Education EF, wasn't she?
Yep.
And as you said, the previous two editions were won by Little Trek. But certainly last year's one points to Roubaix has a habit of just throwing up a completely unexpected winner. And it is very easy to bet against the favourites in this race.
Mm. No, I agree. I think as well, I was speaking to some of the Life Plus Wahoo riders who were not super optimistic about winning the race, but they were saying that seeing Alison Jackson win in the way she did last year from that breakaway gave a lot of riders that belief that they can win at Roubaix. You know, they'd previously thought this is such a tough race. Lizzie Dyde and Lisa Longaborghini, two of the best riders in the world, had won that race with solo attacks. Then suddenly there's this race where it's like, wow, okay, we can win in a breakaway, and the top 10 is riders with very small palmares. And they're thinking, well, if we get in the breakaway and we push and we drive and we try and get to the line, anything can happen. And it's given a lot of belief, as I said. So I think we're going to see a very open race on Saturday at the women's race. I don't know what it's going to be like for SD Works. They've lost Marlon Royce now because she crashed out and broke her jaw in 18th. Capecchi, I think, is going to really, really want to win, which I mean, when that happened at the World Championships, that went very well. At Flanders, it didn't go very well. So I don't think we can put all our eggs in the SD Works basket as we did for Van der Poel a second ago. I would like. I think. I mean, Little Trek tactically have been the best team this Classics campaign, and I would like to see someone like Lucinda Brand get the freedom to go for this.
Lucinda Brand, Elisa Balsamo, I was having a look at as well.
But they've got Ellen van Dijk as well. I mean, there's a good team that tactically can work together really well. I don't see, when they're without Lizzie Deignan, without Elisa Longoburghini, but I don't see why they can't spring another surprise.
Yeah, and to be honest, I was going to talk about Visma, Lisa Bike, whatever the name is at the moment, in both races, because I do think even without Wout van Aert, they've still got plenty of riders capable and arguably the strongest team. So I wouldn't look past Jorgensen, Laporte, Van Baal, plenty of options there, and Marianne Vos. She's
Marianne
back in
Vos.
Form. She popped up last week. She was hanging about looking for scraps.
Well, she's on a bit of a mission this year to win races that she's not yet won. When she won Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, that was a race she'd never won. She's never won Roubaix. So who's to say she can't do it again? Yeah, you know what? I like it. I'm feeling more optimistic about these races being open and not, I mean, as I said, not so much the men's race. But we'll see. Where will you be watching from on Sunday and Saturday and Sunday, Tom?
I'm actually in Italy over the weekend. So,
so will you be watching at all?
I will do my best.
Good for you. That's all we can hope for.
Yeah.
A pleasure, Tom, as always, speaking to you. We're going to wrap things up now. Where, if people want to see us tweet, but we probably won't tweet, can they hopefully see those tweets?
As usual, they can go to TTPDCST on Twitter or Insta.
Wonderful. Episode 95, Tom, and you are still stumbling through the
are we closing
handle.
In on 100?
We're closing in on 100.
Oh, well, there we go.
I don't know what we'll do for that. Maybe we'll just get a load of high percentage beers and get drunk and record something that can never go out.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Okay, great.
From the beer wall in Bruges that we talked about last week.
We'll go to the beer wall in Bruges and record from there. Into gradual abyss, into liminal abyss. Tom, a pleasure as always. I hope you enjoy whatever amount of Roubaix you get to watch. The listener, thank you as always for tuning in, and we will speak to you next time. Take care.
Thanks, everyone.